Okay, well, welcome everybody back. And as much as you're comfortable, if you can turn on your cameras, it helps me kind of feel who's out there. It's nice to, it's always a two-way communication. So I'm going to talk a bit about, share some Dharma about impermanence and not self, and finding freedom in those. And in a sense, Suze is going to do something parallel, but more in terms of experience and in the afternoon. And we're not focusing particularly on dukkha, because this is more the upside of the three characteristics, you might say. So mostly on those first two. So, anyways, wonderful that you're all here. 40 people. That's so amazing to devote yourself to the Dharma for a day. It's really humbling to be in this position. And I just, you know, both of us, just Susan and I were kind of sharing. We just try to kind of get out of the way, in a sense. It's not about us. It's about the Dharma. And so I, some of you know, I often refer to the suttas a little bit in what I share. And in terms of this topic, today's topic, it is a famous sutta where King Pasenadi, he was a contemporary of the Buddha and a student of the Buddha. So he was a king, and he arrived at Jetavana Monastery in now northern Uttar Pradesh. But this is where the Buddha spent more time than anywhere else, Jetavana Monastery. And he wanted to visit the Buddha. But when he was coming in to sit with the Buddha, he was struck by how happy the monastics there were. They were happy. And he compared that, when he talked to the Buddha, he compared that to the ease and joy of the monastics to his own wealthy court, which was full of intrigue and ambition and dissatisfaction. He said, "Here I see monastics living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Here I see monastics smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their facilities, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with mind as aloof as a wild deer's." That is so beautiful. And you know, for most of us, most of the time, our happiness is kind of based on pleasant circumstance. When things feel good, we're happy. When things don't feel good, we're not happy. And in life, we figure this out early on. And most humans spend their lives seeking the pleasant and trying to avoid the unpleasant. And we kind of jostle through life doing this, and we're often vying for a better position against others and is striving to be happy. And, you know, especially in today's consumer society, we're trained to find happiness in products and streaming entertainment and our devices. So this quest for happiness in a way is even more materialistic than it was like a century ago. But 2,600 years ago, the Buddha saw through this treadmill of desire and dissatisfaction. And through his insight, he showed us how to pierce this miasma of grasping and find peace and happiness irrespective of conditionings. Because, you know, think about those monastics for a moment. They were so happy and free, but actually, technically, they were homeless. They didn't have families. They were begging for food. They were sleeping under bushes. But they were radiantly happy. So there's something for us to learn here. Not that we have to sleep under bushes, but there's something for us to learn about freedom from circumstance and being happy. Here's what the Buddha said in a sutta called "With Yourself on an Island." It's in the Connected Discourses. He said, "Here, bhikkhus, the uninstructed worldling," that's this wonderful code word for people who don't practice the Dharma, "the uninstructed worldling regards form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. That form of theirs changes and alters. With the change and alteration of form, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair." So that's the problem, you might say. But here's the solution. "But bhikkhus, when one has understood the impermanence of form, its change, fading away, and cessation, And when one sees it as it really is, with correct wisdom thus, in the past, and also now, all form is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, then sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair are abandoned. With their abandonment, one does not become agitated. Being unagitated, one dwells happily. A bhikkhu who dwells happily is said to be quenched in that respect. So I want to sort of decode a little bit of what he was pointing out there and see if that can help us in our lives. And these two lines, there's mentions of two aspects of the Buddha's teachings, which coupled with our practice of mindfulness are kind of the magic keys to happiness regardless of condition. And these two are impermanence, anicca, and not self, anatta. So that's what I'm going to talk about. So this anicca, this sense of change or motion called impermanence is a core Buddhist concept about which volumes have been written. And how do we see impermanence? Of course, everyone sees the coarser aspects of impermanence, that we all age, that rivers wear down their banks, that the freshest flower or muffin is quickly past its prime. We all see that change. In our own interior lives, if we find a pleasant circumstance that brings us happiness, or try as we might, we can't keep it that way. You know, the most beautiful Hawaiian sunset sinks in the darkness. Our moment of creative success, then we stumble the next time. The most delicious ice cream gets eaten or melts, or we get full. And even the most fulfilling marriage ends in old age and death. And in a subtler way, when we try to settle our attention, our mindfulness on breath in this moment, which comes up unbidden, our legions of thoughts and emotions, pleasant and unpleasant, tied to long stories, and then these things, they disappear, leaving no more trace than a fish through water. So that's not satisfactory either if we are expecting it to stay pleasant. And this blizzard of change, you know, it may seem like a problem with us, like something's wrong, but actually it isn't. We're just seeing the rapidly changing nature of things, how things are, which we haven't noticed before because we weren't attentive enough. That's like the, the challenge of meditation is when we get more attentive, we notice stuff we weren't noticing before. It's like, really? Darn, that's hard. But it's also a doorway. And we haven't seen this movement because what we do as humans, we try to kind of codify and solidify reality around us, and we seek satisfaction in a concocted stability. But a more successful tactic would be to find equanimity in the flow of change. And as we practice mindfulness, we find this understanding of impermanence becomes more and more subtle. So the arising and passing of phenomena moves so fast, things like feel like they're sparkling. We see more clearly, and appearances that had seemed concrete actually reveal how they're made of smaller, transient component parts. There's a term used in Buddhism, dependent arising, which means that everything arises in dependence upon something else. Any thought that arises, any feeling that arises has an origin somewhere, a cause somewhere. It's all interconnected. And because of that constant interplay between all these factors inside of us and factors outside of us, nothing stands still. We may think of our life, you know, our circumstances somehow static, but in fact, it's ever changing. Our mistaken view can be like a person looking out over Puget Sound and thinking the water is just calm like a lake. But actually, if that person looks more closely, they see that Puget Sound's in constant motion with tides and winds keeping the water moving all the time. Our life is like that. Our minds are like that. And this matters because the more deeply we see the impermanent nature of things, really see it, the more our attachment to those things eases. We don't feel like we need to stop them from changing. Says Joseph Goldstein, great Western teacher, I find it a very powerful practice to pay attention moment by moment to the experience of things changing. Rather than just getting lost in the content of what is changing, It is simultaneously possible to pay attention to the fact that experience keeps altering and flowing. This is not such a difficult thing to do, but it is difficult to remember to do it. So if we don't see impermanence, then we'll want to construct our lives around this mistaken notion of safe dependability, and we'll try to blind ourselves to the ever-changing nature of phenomena. And we'll try to stop things changing when they're pleasant, to get them to stay the same. And if things are unpleasant, we're more likely to look at that circumstance as something we want to change to bring ourselves to a more pleasant circumstance, which sometimes is reasonable, but sometimes we can't. And this is this impetus to try to change it and not see through what's unpleasant is based on a background belief that somehow we can get things to stay pleasant. But as we realize impermanence, we just become more comfortable with the reality of change. We're much more able to just accept reality as it happens. We gain the wisdom and equanimity to know what we can change and what we can't, and to be at peace with both, like those happy monks that the king saw. And as we increasingly see the interconnected flux of everything, we become less sticky in life. If things are always moving and changing, made of smaller parts, what's there to cling to? We see our emotions, our thoughts, our pleasant sensations, our sensory experience are all arising and passing. And the more we have this sense of flux in the foreground and the phenomena or the sensations are secondary, we're just not stuck anywhere. So accepting, I'm sort of coming at the same thing several different angles, but accepting this impermanence in our practice and what it means in our lives is a profound step. We shift towards actually seeing the reality of things, this reality that everything's impermanent or inconstant. So the constant change that we see isn't a problem, but an insight. We're having an insight into the nature of things. And this insight into impermanence can become especially powerful, useful, and freeing when we encounter strong pain, whether it be in the heart or the body. Because remember, pain and suffering are different. We all experience pain, but that doesn't mean we have to suffer, even in the middle of strong pain, whether it's whatever it is, physical or emotional. Gil Fronsdal, great Western teacher, says, perhaps you have had an opportunity to bring mindfulness to a strong physical experience such as pain. Isn't that amazing? An opportunity. We tend to see pain through our eyes about it, our ideas about it. With very strong mindfulness, however, we find that we can't pinpoint pain. As soon as we think we have located the pain, it flashes out of existence and reappears a millimeter to the side. It becomes a dance of sparking sensations located in no particular place. Pain that seems solid is actually in constant flux. In this deeper experience of impermanence, we realize that it doesn't make sense to hold on to anything, even temporarily. There's nothing we can hold on to because everything simply flashes in and out of existence. So peace and freedom arise the more we can realize impermanence. And there's a sense of well-being just from realizing how things change. So then the second aspect I wanted to touch on here is not self, anatta. And as we look at the ever-changing interdependence of everything in our mindfulness practice, we begin to understand that constant change also applies to us, to our sense of ourselves. In particular, this applies to our sense of self-identity, who we think we are. You know, our default is to think of ourselves as a specific entity, a self-identity, a myself, a person. We think somehow in our guts that there's an ultimate me in there somewhere, an I in there somewhere, the essence of who we are and who we always will be. And of course, if that would be the case, we would defend that I at all costs and do our best to get the best goodies around the I. That would make sense, right? Conventionally, I'm going to sort of talk here about conventional and ultimate reality. And conventionally, well, there is a self. There is a self. I'm Steve. I've been Steve my whole life. I'm going to die as Steve. But this Steve is a conventional self, and it's really a construct that doesn't have any ultimate or permanent selfhood. For most of us, our conventional sense of self is kind of at the core of our emotional, social, and psychological lives, of our self-identity. You know, think how we react. Think how badly we feel if we're demeaned or accused. And think how puffed up we might feel if we're receiving a lot of praise or recognition. These reflect this concrete sense of self and how we walk through life with that. Have you ever noticed how when people meet, how they're like telling each other the story of themselves to each other to create an identity? That's a lot of what people do. You say, well, here's who I am, here's who I am, here's who I am. But we do that to ourselves, don't we? We tell stories about ourselves to ourselves. That's a lot of what goes on in meditation. When you come back to mindfulness, you've often been telling a story to yourself about yourself. And we review our lives in the past, and we create who we want to be in the future. We tell ourselves stories about ourselves all the time. We're constantly recreating this conventional sense of self and trying to make it more solid. But this is like the most, sticky aspect of human experience, which is why beginning to awaken to not self is so powerful. I can remember when I was young, I think it was in high school, I'm thinking about maybe junior high, but I started to come of age, as an adult, and I could see all these multiple neurotic, time check here, we're good, all these multiple neurotic patterns floating around. And it seemed endless. Like, what is all this stuff? And it wasn't any fun at all. And it made me seem like something was wrong with me. High school's not fun. But I saw all these parts. And at the same time, I started to have a notion that somehow this tangle could be untangled. And somehow these all came from somewhere. And in a sense, this was the beginning of my spiritual journey. Because I just wanted to get to the bottom of it. And I can remember the first time I encountered meditation, had this sense of the possibility of freedom from internal stickiness it offered. This was many decades ago. And since then, the capacity of this practice, of mindful insight practice, has become clearer and clearer. Because using the tools of our mindfulness practice, we can look more deeply at these aspects that make up this sense of self. And look more deeply. When we see through those, we start to see, ultimately, there is no self there. As we're mindful of these factors of rising and passing, arising and passing, our inherent sense of self starts to just break apart. It starts to kind of untangle. And we see more clearly in the constant arising and passing of thoughts and memories and emotions and sensations in practice, the very thing that seems like they're a problem, but when we keep bringing mindfulness to them, we start to see there's no core self anywhere. Where is it? Where is it? Have we ever seen an unchanging self in our bodies, in our minds, in our thoughts? Where is it? We can't find it. We can't find it. The Buddha concluded we could not find that. So powerfully that when he offered this to the five ascetics in the second sutta, this was the second time he taught in Sarnath after he was awakened, and he went there. I think it's 130 miles he walked because he, in his mind's eye, he saw that the five ascetics were there. And he said to them, "You should truly see any kind of consciousness at all, past, future, or present, internal or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness with right understanding. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself." It said that about all the five skandhas, the five aggregates that make us up. It's repeated the same thing. And it said that all five of them awakened right in that moment. which if that happens to you, far out in this moment. But it's so pivotal. So this is a truth that an awakening that only deepens with practice. So, you know, keep at it. Keep looking for yourself and see what you find. But this is one of the amazing things about this practice, that just when it seems like it doesn't work because our minds are a clutter of stuff about ourselves, those are the doorways right there. So don't be bothered by that. Just keep becoming mindful in those moments. And this lack of self is a very deep subject in Buddhism called not self or anatta. And when applied more broadly, not just to the personal self, but to all phenomena, it's called emptiness. In classic Buddhist teachings, the question of lack of inherent existence of things is often approached by analyzing the lack of inherent existence of a chariot. Back 2,600 years ago, we don't have many chariots around. So this being 2021, let's look at a bicycle. I mean, the essential question is there an inherent bicycle? It's the same thing as, is there an inherent self? I mean, you look at a bicycle, where is the bicycle? You remove the wheels, is it still a bicycle? Or take off the seats or handlebars? What is it now? Where is the bicycle? Maybe it's the frame. Oh, that's just junk without those other parts. It's not really a bicycle. So you can see how the identity of this bunch of parts depends on how we think about them, how we see them, and also how they function together. And that's how it is with everything. That's how it is with everything. Everything's made of parts which come together and come apart over time, and we impute meaning or definition upon them. There's no inherent chariot or bicycle, just a collection of parts. And it's the same with us. Our self is made of parts of body, perceptions, thoughts, memories, consciousness. And there's no inherent person there any more than is an inherent bicycle. So truly realizing, you know, the more we realize not self and emptiness, it changes everything, because we realize more deeply there's nothing to get attached to, because there's no thing there to get attached to, and there's nobody to get attached, because there's no self here to get attached. It just opens it up. There's no self to get attached. There's no things to get attached to, ultimately. And this is a deep freedom from clinging that brought happiness to the monks that King Pasenadi saw. And this is a deep freedom from clinging that brings happiness to the Dalai Lama. You know, that amazing radiant happiness he has. Or other great spiritual beings you may have encountered. It can bring happiness to each one of us, and it does already. You know, each one of us has found tastes of freedom in your practice, or else you wouldn't be here. So it accumulates over time. And always rejoice. Rejoice in what you've seen. You know, rejoice in what you've seen. You're already in a categorically different space than a lot of folks. I've been struck during the, as an aside, during the pandemic, you know, I sort of got a lot of communications with people and practitioners around different places. And for so many people, this has become sort of like a long protracted retreat. And, you know, people that practice deeply, and they're like, I mean, they empathize with the suffering, and it's been kind of a drag, but it hasn't been a crisis. I mean, hopefully they're not sick in that kind of difficulty, but just the circumstance has been not a problem in a lot of ways. So it's because of this equanimity and happiness arising just from the freedom of not clinging internally and not clinging with themselves. So this is anatta showing us something very important. It's showing us that the sense of self we hold so deeply, which we defend with such ferocity, actually is as ever-changing as sunlight on moving water. We're not the same person today that we were yesterday, or last week, or a minute ago, or a second ago. Everything's in flux. Everything's in relation to everything else. None of it's permanent. So don't, you know, obviously accept what I'm saying. Just raise this question in terms of your mindfulness practice and see what you see. and look at this, what this means in your day-to-day human life, you know, and the freedom it brings you. It makes things less sticky. It means that aspects of your personality, some of which you like, some of which you don't, are not you. There is no you to have problems. There's just stuff. And even if you're going through a crisis, we had a little family crisis last week, and it was really painful, and I felt a lot of pain. But I could also breathe into it and have some space with it. And the same applies to the people in your lives. You know, the qualities they have, which you may find attractive or repellent, they're also not permanent or inherent. They're not inherently theirs. There's nobody there to condemn. We have to bring that same compassion in our understanding of them that we bring to ourselves. So, you know, this all comes alive in our mindfulness practice. This isn't theory. This is what we see. So watch, you know, watch in your practice, and Suze will be talking about this afternoon. Watch in your practice how this arises and what this means in your lives. And realizing impermanence and not self, it brings not clinging. And that brings happiness, like the Buddha said. Just like those monks sitting on the dirt who were happy, that made the king wish he was more like them. Although it was hard for him to let go of his power. But we can be free in the middle of what we got to do.